the movements of hundreds of soil engineers, digging, rolling, and fertilising a pasture. And as they're going, they're doing us all a favour. The more that they do this, the less bush flies will be at our next barbecue. This is the sound, incidentally, of the inside of a cowpat. It's the sound of a long-running biological control project run out of the CSIRO. These are dung beetles. Hello, I'm Anne Jones, and on Off Track today, I promise we're not spending all of our time inside a cowpat, but we are here to talk dung beetles with one of the co-authors of the latest field guide in the Off Track collection, Introduced Dung Beetles in Australia. Jane Wright is a retired scientist with the CSIRO.
The dung beetle project started in the late 60s with a recognition by a scientist at CSIRO, his name was George Bornemissza, that there were all these dung pads and no beetles acting on it, the way he had observed in his native Hungary. And he convinced the then chief of the division, Doug Waterhouse, that this was an important thing to do. So the project got rolling, and it was all about burying dung, getting it off the surface of the paddocks, because when it sits on the top, it smothers the grass. The grass that grows around it is rank. The cattle don't like it. And in fact, the graziers were having to drag harrows across the fields to break up these hard pads of dung. So that's how it all started. And so they went to various places, but largely southern Africa, to look for species that would be compatible with Australia's climate and so on.
I never knew that we had this CSIRO presence in South Africa, and you were one of the people that actually worked there.
Yes, I was. I was at the very end of it. I had was just finishing my PhD. You can tell from my accent I'm Canadian, but I did my PhD in the United States, and I did it in biological control of insects. So I was looking for a job like that, and what came up but a job with CSIRO to work on biological control of dung and dung breeding flies to be posted in South Africa. It was like a dream come true, and I actually got the job. So my first job was with CSIRO to go to South Africa to look at predatory insects that would go into cattle dung and feed on fly eggs and larvae. And we were looking at flies that more or less corresponded to the buffalo fly that occurs in Queensland that takes blood meals off cattle. And anyway, so that went on for about 3 years, and then the money stopped and life intervened, and I took a detour through stored products research and research management. And then I retired and want to go back to dung beetles, because I never really felt I'd finished what I wanted to do. And so the opportunity came up to do this again in my retirement. I saw it as an opportunity to have one more chance to try and finish the job. Not that it's ever going to be finished. And so here we are in a paddock, and it has been just a marvelous journey.
Jane Wright and I are standing in that paddock with Patrick Gleeson, a research technician with the CSIRO. And he's got a concreter's trowel, which he's using to investigate cowpats.
We're on a farm just northwest of Murrin Bateman, a little bit southeast of Yass.
And it's just gorgeous. It's rolling hills. But we're here to talk about cattle dung.
Well, it's a pile of about 3 litres of manure dung, cow dung, that the cow voids, and it sort of splots on the ground depending on how dry the grass is. It's a bit firmer if it's dry grass, a bit sloppier if it's green grass.
How many cowpats will one cow produce?
About 12.
12 a day?
About 12 a day.
That's
a lot. And of course, you know, little animals produce little pads and big animals produce big pads.
And they're bigger in the morning too when they wake up, the cows. So if we look a bit closer and start flicking around, we should just see them scattering into their tunnels as we turn over the dung.
So what am I looking for?
Oh, a little beetle.
A little beetle. So we might see his bum heading down
the
hole.
Yeah, you'll see his bum heading into the... Oh, there's one there.
Oh.
There's another one.
Wow.
Just pick them up.
Absolutely, the mood is small fulvous.
Yeah, probably. Halopetes occurs here.
So field identification is clearly a challenge.
Oh, yes.
Can be.
But
yeah.
The thing is, once you...
Get your eye in.
Get your eye in, it's actually... and there are key things that you learn to look for with each one. Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's just fulvous.
Yeah.
So what have we got here?
Unitocellus fulvus.
That was a magnificent pronunciation of that first bit, which is Unitocellus. That's really well done. What can you tell me about this little guy?
It's one of the smaller ones. It's a little bit less to a little more than a centimeter long. It's light brown with sort of speckly bits on it. It doesn't have a prominent horn in the males like other species do. It comes from Europe, including the Middle East and North Africa. And it's established well across Australia.
You can see that they get along almost, in human terms, it would almost be like those army crawls where you see people go on their tummy and they're drawing themselves with their forearms. Is that when he stops and is he cleaning
his antenna?
He's cleaning his antenna to sense where to go next.
Yes.
So just like it, like you see an ant cleaning their antenna, he's doing exactly the same behaviour.
Yeah.
Their silhouette is that classic Beatles silhouette.
Yeah, and some of our beetles are, to be quite honest, sort of boring looking. They're black and dull and not very exciting. But there are some beautiful ones. And what really strikes a lot of people sometimes is the iridescent blue or green in some species and the horns on the males. Now, the horns on the males are all about sexual selection and getting the best females and getting the most females. And so big horns on dung beetles are pretty awesome.
Oh, that one looks juicy. Yeah, I am talking about a cowpat. It's an extremely valuable resource to all the dominant species in the farming ecosystem, both desirable and less welcome.
It provides a breeding medium for bushflies in the south and buffalo flies in the north. And these are species that specifically lay eggs in cattle dung, and then they breed through and they can go through remarkably fast, just a couple of weeks from egg to adult. And so a nice big fresh pad with good moisture content can produce thousands of flies.
Oh my
and,
God.
Yeah, it's huge. The other thing that we have to always remember is that's a lot of nutrient. A lot of people go to the garden center and buy composted cow manure to put in their garden, and there's a good reason for that. So part of the value of getting the dung beetles working is it takes all that dung down into the soil where it's then available for the plants to grow from.
So how exactly do dung beetles do that?
Well, basically the adult beetle, you know, they're flying around in the paddock and they'll find a reasonably fresh pad and they'll land on it and tunnel directly into it. As the male and the female, they hook up and they dig a tunnel. They pack that tunnel full of dung, and depending on the species, they can be like a sausage length size, you know, just like a regular barbecue sausage, you know, quite thick, depending on the size of the beetle, of course. And they lay an egg in one end, and that's all directly under the pad.
Will they build just the one tunnel and do the one set of eggs per lifetime, or will they multiply mate?
Oh, they do it again and again.
Yeah.
And each species has a different sort of strategy. Some species will make lots of tunnels and multiple egg masses, and then they'll go on and make to the next fresh pad and do it again and do it again and do it again. And some of those species will go through several generations in a year. They develop fast, and so you can have a quick increase in population. But then we've got some other ones, which are often bigger beetles, and they produce many fewer eggs, but they actually take care of them. And it will take the dung down and basically make a brood ball and take care of its offspring underground. So it's the other kind of life strategy. It's put a lot of energy into a few offspring, taking care of them to ensure their survival, whereas the other strategy is, you know, it's like scattergun. And there's a place for both in our dung beetle pasture ecosystem because they can kind of help balance each other out.
Introducing anything into a system, whether that be an animal of the size of a buffalo or cattle, right down to a dung beetle, has to have an effect though. What are the negatives about dung beetle releases?
Okay. As far as we can tell, there are none. But having said that, there is a very strict protocol. When we bring the beetles in, we bring them into quarantine. We make sure that they're clean, that they don't have any mites or nematodes or whatever. We brought the eggs out of quarantine by basically sterilizing the surface so that only the clean egg came out. I'd also did a lot of research to show that there were no bad things in the eggs. So we go to a lot of trouble, even for something as safe as dung beetles are, because they only eat dung, they don't eat anything else. We still go to a lot of trouble to make sure we get it just right.
So what about the native dung beetles, of which there are hundreds of species out there? Do these guys offer some sort of competition to those native beetles?
Well, that was another reason why the beetles were selected that preferred cattle dung instead of marsupial dung, pelleted stuff, which is what our native ones have developed on. A few Australian species do transfer well to cattle dung, but very few.
So it's unlikely then that these dung beetles, if we removed all cattle from this area, that these dung beetles would be able to survive?
That's correct. They would fly and fly and fly to see if they could find some cattle somewhere else, but there'd be very little else they could do.
With perfect timing for Off Track on RN, the farmer who owns this land joins us out in the paddock. This place, Jeremy Wilson explains, is biodynamic.
So we don't use any poisons, so we cultivate as beetles as best we can.
So how much do you actually notice the dung beetles?
Oh, lots. Very active, I guess. We started looking at them back in about 92, just after we first came, and children were starting to do work on things at school, and so we went and took cowpats and put them into the fridge to cool down, and then put them into buckets of water to float off the sleepy beetles so they wouldn't too sleepy to fly away. And that was fascinating, but certainly the numbers have increased dramatically.
What do you put that down to?
I'm sure that not using chemicals on the farm at all, that it provides a much better basis for them. Other people do get them, but then they use a lot of very unfriendly drenches in their animals, which are just completely destroy the growth of these things.
Now, on the fly control aspect, from a farmer's perspective, why don't you want flies around?
I want to use my hands for something other than swatting the blasted things. No, they're a great nuisance for the cattle. You'll see them flapping their ears constantly. Occasionally, we wind up, and certainly a lot of other producers wind up with a problem with what's called pink eye. It's a biological infection in the eye, which causes the cattle a tremendous amount of distress. We cure that by squirting cod liver oil into their eyes, which is pretty disgusting smells, but it works. But it causes the cattle a lot of problems, and flies certainly spread it in some seasons.
Right, so the flies essentially coming at the animals for moisture.
Yes, exactly right.
But it's also protein. They need protein from the animal secretions, the females do, to mature their eggs. And some research done by a scientist at CSIRO called Marina Tindell-Bisco showed that when flies develop in poor quality dung, they come out very small and they're very hungry. Whereas a big fly, the female already has enough nutrient to actually produce a few eggs. But little flies have to eat and eat and eat, and they are the peskiest. The bush flies are the little ones because they're so desperate to get protein to develop the eggs.
Talked about horns before. You want to hold that, Jane, please?
Yeah, sure.
This is called Ontophagus taurus, and you can see why it's called taurus, as in cow, bull. It's got these very large curved horns on its head.
Wow! They're curved backwards, curved like the one that you see those utes have.
Yeah, like the...
Yep.
Yeah. Ooh. Oop. It's slippery.
They're very slippery and very active on a hot day like today.
And it's fantastic because we're looking for soil improvement in those seasons when it's moist. But here we have soil improvement when the soil is really dry. These little blighters taking the dung down and keeping it open and working.
Oh, that's it.
Fantastic, isn't it?
Ooh, wait, we're being called over.
Well, I'd broken this pad open and the dung beetles are flying into it. I've collected quite a few now just waiting, and they're so if we just watch for a sec, you'll see they're going to kind of... They are flying in. It's absolutely fabulous.
So what are they attracted to? Is it the moisture?
The smell.
The smell.
They can smell it.
Really?
Oh, yes. It's food. They basically come in to fresh pads because that gives them the longest amount of time to bury it before it starts getting too dry and hard. Also, it's first in, best dressed, because when there are a lot of dung beetles around, there's huge competition for the pads. So they want to get straight in right away, get busy, and get as much dung as they can for themselves and their offspring.
And to give you an idea of the competition, this is what sound you get when you get really close to a cowpat with a very powerful microphone. And you can also hear a yelling cocky in the background too, but he wouldn't be quiet. Now, it might sound like rain, but it's actually hundreds of dung beetles digging for their lives. On RN, this is Off Track. My name is Anne Jones, and in the interests of bringing you the best in natural history that I can each week, I've dragged some very special microphones out of the storage rooms of the ABC. And the first test was a hydrophone. This is a smallish bullet-shaped microphone on a really long cord, and it's designed to drop off boats or a jetty so you can listen what's going on under the water. I didn't tell the sound engineers that I was going to put it into a cowpat, though. That's tens, possibly somewhere between 100 and 200 small dung beetles, all pushing material around inside the cowpat, moving, burying, mating, generally getting on with things. They sound remarkably industrious. And then I wondered if I could construct some sort of drum for the dung beetles to walk over so you could hear the rhythm of their movement. So I put plastic film over a container and then I taped a very sensitive strip microphone to that. And as we place a beetle on the surface, you can hear the texture of its legs. They're spiky, almost hairy. And this one, by the way, is Geotrupes spiniger, about 2 centimetres long. It's native to Europe, occurring right down through the Middle East and to the Pakistani border. It's also established here in Australia, in Tasmania, Victoria, and parts of New South Wales. There he goes. And he's not alone. There are 23 established species of introduced dung beetles active in pastoral areas across Australia. Some like the northern parts of Australia and some like the south, and all of them hibernate at some point during the year. So if we've got all of that, then why bother releasing new species in Australia at all? Jane Wright.
What we identified was there was this major gap in late winter and early spring when there were no dung beetles present. And that's a time when the grass is really growing,
yeah,
and the cattle are, you know, really munching and there's a lot of dung. And we're wasting all that nutrient if it's not going into the soil. So that's the one side. And the second part of it is that that's also the time of year when the bush flies are reintroduced to the south. It's on the weather because they die out here in the south every winter. And so it means that if we've got dung beetles active already when the flies arrive, then we don't let them have such a a free run.
So we've heard that dung beetles are great for the productivity of herds and pastures, and it's really for those reasons that the Meat and Livestock Council of Australia has been one of the key funding bodies for this research, which has culminated in the release of two species.
Their names are Onthophagus vacca and Bubus bubalis, which are lovely names. We'll call them vacca and bubalis for short. Vacca and bubalis come from predominantly France. They also occur in Spain, and vacca occurs in Morocco. We've imported them from France, partly because they're most abundant there, and also because CSIRO has a field laboratory there with really good people who were able to work with us and do a lot of the work for us.
To keep them alive and breed up a population that is ready for release, you have to feed them something. That means you have to collect poo. Patrick Gleeson describes the process of collecting cowpats and making brood balls to breed dung beetles.
It's skilled because we've got to make sure it's fresh. We don't want anything that's been on the ground too long, which may have maggots, fly maggots in it, or other rubbish or dirt or stuff that's been kicked into it from the cows or whatever. But basically it's just you get a little trowel and a dustpan. And we have a trolley, and we have a rubbish bin, plastic rubbish bin on the trolley. And we trundle through the paddock where the cows are, because that's usually where the freshest pads are, or where the cows have slept the night before. So we just trundle through the paddocks with our little trolleys, and we just load up. When we see a pad, we bend down and slide it onto our tray.
And we get very good at knowing how old a pad is. So you go along and you tap it. No, that's too old. No, that'll be right. Yep. Scrape, scrape, scrape into the bucket. And then, of course, when we get back, we then mix it with, you know, those paint stirrers on
electric drill.
On electric drill.
I would call that process a cow patagino. You know,
well, I suppose. So we mix it all up really well, and then we would package it up into either takeaway, 1 liter takeaway containers, or into bags that we then packed into boxes, and then they all went into the freezer.
We freeze it in a big minus 20 shipping container for a while to kill anything that might have come in, like maggots or other beetles and things like that, and then we'd thaw that out, and then we put it into a fruit press. We'd stick it into a pillowcase just so it doesn't go everywhere. And we put it into a fruit press, like you're squeezing grapes or apples or something to make juice, and squeeze it right down. And that gets rid of a lot of the excess moisture. And that sort of makes the moisture content a sort of a very similar to what the female beetle would produce for her brood. After that, it was all about fashioning it into little balls. And so we'd sit around all together, the team, and we'd be gloves on and rolling balls for an afternoon, poking a little hole with the end of a pencil in the top, which is about the right size to place an egg when we bring the eggs out of quarantine.
How big were the little balls?
Well, for Onthophagus vacca, which is a small species, which is 5 to 7 millimetres long, they were probably half the size of a golf ball, I suppose. And then with Bubus bubalis, which is a lot bigger, that's a 2 centimetre beetle or so, they were more like somewhere between a tennis ball and a cricket ball.
Oh, wow.
So a reasonable amount of dung.
So I'm imagining sort of like a tray that's full of balls, and you've poked the little hole with your pencil and you've put one of the eggs inside each ball. Yep. What do you do next?
Often we just let them be like that, and we put them into our controlled temperature rooms and watch the eggs hatch. And then we were sure that the egg had survived the egg sterilisation process out of quarantine, so we knew it was viable. And so we'd watch it, the little larvae, a little tiny little thing, start feeding on the dung. And then once we worked out that they were feeding, we'd just gently close over, pinch the top of the little hole that we put in the dung over, and then just let them be. And hopefully we saw an adult beetle come out the other end.
And did you?
Yes, of course. Yeah, lots.
There was one further complicating factor among all of the breeding and quarantine procedures. These beetles spoke French. What I mean is, they came directly in from the Northern Hemisphere, the opposite seasons to the Southern Hemisphere here in Australia. So if you want to release them into a paddock here, you need to reset their yearly biorhythms.
The challenge for us was that these are species that have one generation a year. So we had to manipulate the conditions in the lab to convince them that summer was winter and winter was summer, because they were 6 months out of phase. So that was a challenge, a real challenge. And we were able to alter things sufficiently to get one species to go through almost twice in a year. With the other species, we could only shorten the life cycle by about 3 months. So it took a few generations to get them into sync, but we got there.
What do you do? Do you put them in a climate-controlled lab where you are tricking them into thinking the seasons are changing?
Absolutely. Trying to get them to have had enough time at high temperatures and then enough time at low temperatures for them to know that winter had happened, now it was time to come out in spring.
So what's the physical process of actually releasing the beetles?
Well, if you've got adult beetles in a box, just like I have here from the some I've collected today, it's just a matter of going to a fresh pad and tipping out the box.
And you see, gloriously simple.
Yeah, gloriously simple. The dung beetles will just go straight into the dung and bury themselves. And you go, well, see you later. That's as simple as that. But in our case, we had to release juvenile stages, so larval stages, still in their brood balls or brood masses. And so that involved digging a trench. We dug it, you know, about 30 centimetres, 40 centimetres deep, and we had to be very careful about, you know, making sure the trench drained well. We didn't want to drown the beetles if there was big rains or something like that. And then we put the broods in the bottom of the trench and then just fill the trench in and hope for the best. So when the beetles were ready to, you know, when they themselves think they've developed fully, I think that they've the soil moisture is correct, the temperature is right, they'll hopefully emerge all by themselves.
You said with other species, you know, it's 20 years on when you're finding a population that's established. Do you expect it will be 20 years before we know?
I would hope that at most of our sites we'd find beetles again in 5 years, maybe less, we'll see. But anyway, it means that I have a really good excuse to go out travelling every early spring and see what I can find. It's wonderful being retired.
Well, I don't know that you ever actually retire from being a scientist, do you?
Well, no, you don't. You don't retire, and you definitely do it more for love than money. But it was something important to do. So we've done it. And so it's funny, I had to retire to actually do what I trained for. But, you know, life happens.
Jane Wright is a retired scientist with the CSIRO and co-author of The Pocket Guide to the Introduced Dung Beetles in Australia. The details of the book are over on the website. Patrick Gleeson is a CSIRO research technician who has attended the birthdays of thousands of dung beetles over the last couple of years. And Jeremy Wilson, owner of Golden Home, a biodynamic beef farm home to thousands, probably hundreds of thousands, of happily cowpat entombed dung beetles. And I'm Ann Jones. This is Off Track on RN, and after I disinfect the microphones, I'll be back at the same time next week, ready to take you somewhere else.